And it pretty much just reinforces just what you said right there. We're still on that chapter 4, and we're talking about the analysis of the clarity, not going beyond definitions to the concept itself. And not only do you define the individual terms, but then you have to see how the usage of these, not only in its context and the concept, the idea, but also how it's being used in ordinary language, how, you know, it doesn't have to be a word that means two different things, but how is it being used in the common language? I'm trying to think of a good example. Let me see if they give one here. Page 62, well, we're going to probably have to move on because I'm real behind, but even when he gets to the real definitions on page 62, starting off the second paragraph, he says, it is crucial, Geisler and Feinberg say, it is crucial to note that real definitions can be true or false, because that says what the thing really is or is supposed to, while nominal definitions cannot. In other words, if the English language arbitrarily says that bachelors are unmarried males, then that's the meaning that was arbitrarily given to it. If that's the dictionary definition of the word, that's what it is. But a real definition, we might throw into it and say, okay, well, a human being is this and that, and start adding things that human beings have hair on their head. And no, they don't have to have hair on their head. Keep that in mind. Let me see. He says he talks a little bit about analysis of concepts. It begins with examination of definitions, but it does not stop there. It seeks to observe the usage of these words, usually, though not always, in ordinary language. You know, how is the word human being used? How is the word human used in ordinary language? But also, how is this particular guy that is debating me or discussing philosophy with me, how is he using that word? And so it takes the word not alone, but in the context of the subject, the whole concept, the whole idea itself, and tries to analyze. All it's saying, all clarity is saying is, before you can know if what John is saying is true or not, before you can decide whether what John is saying is true or false, clarify what he is saying. Have him define his terms, and then analyze the concepts that he's teaching. And then decide, well, in other words, before you can decide whether what he's saying is true or false, you've got to understand what he's saying. That's all that's being said there. Mormons say that Jesus is their Savior. Mormons say Jesus is God. But they define Savior and God in totally different ways than we define it. When you really get out to the real definition of what they're saying, totally different thing. Jesus is God, is one of many gods, and he's getting better as God, progressing as God. You can be a God someday. And Jesus is your Savior, dying on the cross so that you'll be resurrected. If you believe in him, you'll be resurrected someday so that you can be judged by your works. But your works are going to determine whether or not you're going to be able to go to the third heaven and progress in God or in that type of thing. They use the same terms, but they define it totally different. And that's part of philosophical dialogue and debate. You've got to clarify what it is your opponent is saying before you can determine whether or not you agree with them. Every once in a while, I will hear guys in a heated debate that sometimes they're saying the same thing in different words, or saying approximately the same thing in different words. We're still talking the tools of philosophy. Again, we have to talk a little bit about the scientific method. Scientific method. you have two basic things in the scientific method. You have analytic statements and synthetic statements, okay? Analytic statements and synthetic statements. Analytic statements are also called tautologies. They're true by definition. It's like all bachelors are unmarried males. That's true by definition. If it's tautology, it's an analytical statement. Their denial is a contradiction. Okay, the true by that, if you deny that bachelors are unmarried males, it would be a contradiction to say a bachelor is a married male. The true by definition, their denial is a contradiction. Problem is, you know, 1 + 1 = 2. That's true by definition. When you define what one is, and you define what one is, and you add them together, you necessarily end up with two. It's true by definition. The problem is, though, they say nothing about the world. They say nothing about the world, things that are true by definition. Okay? Analytical statements are what is called in Latin a priori. A priori. You will need to know that. In fact, analytic and synthetic things, before we get to tests, we're going to go over the glossary, different terms that you got to know, and a good glossary in the back of the book. Analytical statements are a priori. All that means is self-evident truths prior to experience. Prior to any experience of them, they're known to be true before you investigate them or whatever. Okay? Prior to experience or prior to experimenting with something or evidencing it, okay? Now, synthetic statements are a posteriori, okay? That's the Latin word. It just basically means that their truth is determined by an appeal to factual evidence. The evidence must be examined. Their truth is determined by an appeal to factual evidence. In other words, if I believe something a priori, I believe it before looking at the facts. But if I believe something a posteriori, that's the conclusion I came to after looking at the facts. Okay? If I believe that, the illustrations are going to be a little false, so I don't want to get into that too much. But this is after the evidence, this is before the evidence. Some people say that miracles cannot occur. Here's a faulty argument because it's pretending to be a posteriori, but then, by the way, you might notice something here. We're saying the same thing in different language. Analytical statement. If you got an a priori, something that was true a priori, what kind of argument would it be? Well, what kind of argument would it be, though, if your first premise was that?
Deductive.
Because if that first premise was a posteriori, it would have to be inductive. Okay, that's what we're going to see. The scientific method is in this realm, in the synthetic realm. But the David Hume's argument against miracles, one of his arguments against miracles, he tries to get you to think he's arguing inductively, when in actuality, he's arguing deductively. His mind is made up ahead of time. What he's actually saying, he says, he defines miracles. Miracles are violations. A miracle is a violation of natural laws. Okay, like the law of gravity, essentially. Miracle is a violation of the natural laws. However, natural laws cannot be violated. Therefore, miracles cannot occur. That sounds real good. But how do you prove the premise natural laws cannot be violated? Only if you a priori, before looking at all the evidence, assume that miracles never happen. That's what's called a circular argument. What he's saying is, for miracles to occur, but
in order for those miracles to occur, a miracle would have to occur.
In order for miracles to occur, a miracle would have to occur, but miracles are impossible, therefore miracles can't occur. But he's assuming, right in his front premises, he's assuming the conclusion. By saying natural laws cannot be violated, you could translate that as miracles cannot occur.
Right. And they concluded that, therefore miracles cannot occur.
So he hasn't really examined. Now, how would you prove miracles, miracles?
You really can't.
You can't. You have to become God.
How can you prove that miracles have never occurred a posteriori? You have to examine every event that ever occurred up to now and prove that could all be explained as naturalistically by natural causes. But then, that would say nothing about what's going to occur tomorrow. Even David Hume argued that. David Hume says, just because the sun rises every morning doesn't mean that we can know with certainty that it's going to rise tomorrow. So you would think, using that premise, you would think that he would argue, therefore we can't disprove miracles. At the same time, he turns around and tries to disprove miracles. But anyway, a priori, you believe something before looking at the evidence. A posteriori, you believe something after looking at the evidence. Okay? To say homosexuality is wrong. You say, why? I don't know, it's just wrong. And you're saying you hold that belief a priori. To say homosexuality is wrong, and they say, why? You say, well, number one, I think there's good evidence that the Bible is God's word, and the Bible calls it wrong. Number two, it's unnatural. It is just the homosexual practice is not natural. Number three, it's a breeding ground, incubation ground for all kinds of diseases, and this and that, and bringing down our country, your return of hepatitis B, your return. There you're arguing posteriori, okay? The other one is just a belief with no evidence for it. But in actuality, very few of the beliefs are really out for it. There's usually something, some gut feeling or something. But like you say, eventually you can't find reasons for everything.
Well, what
eventually, something's got to be held a priori. And
what happens if you begin a belief a priori and then you attempt to back that up?
In one sense,
you would have to basically be going from a priori to a posteriori.
Well, the thing is, you can do it, but you've got to do it in the right way. If you say, like, for instance, you'd be making a fool of yourself, you say, I believe it's a priori because of these reasons.
Yeah.
Well, then you don't believe it a priori. However, if you say, I have an a priori belief, which I can prove to you, but which I can find confirmation for it better than your a priori beliefs. Okay? If you said, I have an a priori belief, that I could prove to you with logical necessity, that's ludicrous. But if you say I have an a priori belief, that if you deny this a priori belief, it makes communication meaningless. For instance, I believe that I exist, and I believe that a priori, without looking at the evidence. But if I seek some confirmation for it, I find that is one of Geisler's big premises. You got it from Aquinas, you got it from Aristotle. If I find that in order to deny my existence, I must actually exist to make the denial, because nothing is nothing, therefore nothing does nothing, therefore nothing can deny nothing. Just to deny my existence, I have to exist in the first place to make the denial. Then we could say, well, we've got a principle of actual undeniability that would back my a priori belief that I exist. But once we start looking for, technically speaking, once we start looking for belief of an a priori belief, it leaves the realm of the a priori. Okay? But eventually, foundationalism says there's got to be, things we get way ahead. Foundationalism says eventually we have to find some foundational truths which we just accept without evidence for them because they're so self-evident or they're true beyond reasonable doubt. Okay? And I am a foundationalist. But I'm not a strict foundationalist in that I don't believe we can know these things with logical necessity, but I think that we can know them to be true beyond all reasonable doubt, or we have to assume them to live normal lives.
In which you differ from a presuppositionist who will say you just have to decide that this is going to be true and you're going to base everything on this.
Now, even a presuppositionalist to a certain degree, I believe, could be considered a foundationalist. He presupposes it's foundational.
Whereas the
foundationalist would be different from a guy who believes in the coherent view of truth. We're getting too far ahead, but there's others that believe in a web of truth, that it's okay to argue circular. How do you know A is true? Well, because of B. Well, how do you know C is true? Well, because of A. Well, how do you know A is true? Well, because of B. And you keep arguing in a circle, and so you have no foundation for your belief, because A proves B, and it's like, how do I know that Kurt is reliable? Well, because John told me he's reliable. Well, how do I know that John is reliable? Well, Doug told me he's reliable. Well, how do I know Doug is reliable? Well, Kurt told me he's reliable. You see the problem there?
Yeah.
We haven't proved anybody's reliable. And that's what the alternative to foundationalism is. The foundational position would either be that we would have to know infallibly that Kurt is reliable, or we've got real good evidence that says that Kurt, it's beyond reasonable doubt that Kurt is not reliable, so we're going to really assume he's reliable, and because he said John is reliable, there's no real reason for us to deny it.
Where does the web, is that from like existential?
The web, I don't even want to get into it yet, because it's just basically... It's more of a web of foundationalism. It's more of a pyramid. You get your foundational beliefs on the bottom, backing these other beliefs. The other one, it's a web. I mean, you can just go in all directions, man. It's just like all over the place. But I don't want to get into it right now. But anyway, the scientific method deals with those synthetic things. Is to tell. To tell us if a statement is true or reliable, you have to formulate the statement clearly. We went through the steps of scientific medicine. I'm not going to do that again, but basically we worded it a different way. You formulate the statement clearly and carefully, okay, so we understand what's being said. Then we have to try to predict the implications of such a belief. You don't need to jot this down right now. You can look at my notes afterwards, and I'm really going to be rushing here. Then you have controlled experiments to test the predictions, and then you would accept or reject the statement, okay? So first you formulate the statement, you predict the implications, of such, you make predictions of such a belief. You can have controlled experiments to test these predictions, and then you either accept or reject the statement based on whether those predictions came true or not. Now, we are super behind here, but deductive syllogism is just a fancy word for a deductive argument. Deductive syllogisms, there are certain rules about them. If you got your textbook, open it up, you're going to want to look at it for this. You are not going to be tested on it. So this is a course in logic, you would definitely be tested on it. This is pages 64 or 68. Basically, use the first rule, I would put it down as, use only three terms. Okay, let me write the deductive syllogism on the board. All men are mortal. Socrates is a man. Conclusion, Socrates is mortal. Okay?
That is a syllogism right there.
Yeah, deductive syllogism. You know, it's a deductive argument. First off, you can only use three terms.
What's the term?
Okay. Basically, all the term is, look, you can tell it if we use like a fallacy of four terms. A term is your main subject, or not even subject, but men and man, you know, man is part of that same term, men. Okay, so that's one. Mortal and Socrates. See, so you only have three. The fallacy of four terms would violate this. It would be if you said all men are mortal, Socrates is a man, therefore Socrates is gigantic. Okay. Yeah, that's a gigantic of four terms. Nowhere in the premises. How can you get a conclusion like that from the premises? Makes no sense at all. Okay? So only three terms could be used. All bats are animals. Flappy is a bat. Therefore, Flappy is an animal. Okay?
Real high ground class.
Again, three terms. You got bats, you got Flappy, and you got the animals. And then there's Flappy and there's the animals. You got the three terms. Fallacy of four terms. Look at the illustration they give. Cows are brown. There are two terms already. Animals have four legs. Now you got four terms already, so obviously this conclusion is going to be out to lunch. Therefore, cows have four legs. And, well, cows do usually have four legs, but that is not a valid argument. That the fallacy of four terms. See, he says we have four terms. Cows, brown, animals, and four legs.
So, when it comes to deductive syllogisms, we have to apply term limits.
Oh, no.
One thing you want is
talking automatic failure, man.
One thing you want is philosophical debate is a good sense of humor. It's not one of his rules, but it should be one of the rules of deductive syllogism. Try out the jokes on friends before you see things for a mixed crowd.
Now, something is another rule. It's something I've noticed that both of your process contains a term which is your general term. Is that a rule?
Yeah.
Both terms have a bat in it. Because if you were to say Flappy is an animal, therefore Flappy is a bat, that would work.
An
animal, it could be
a
bat.
Yeah, you've got to have, and this is too...
Is that a specific rule or is that...
Yeah, you'll see it when it comes, but it's just worded in a way that it doesn't explain it. Things got to be distributed. Let's look at rule two. I'll read right from the book. First I'll give you the way I put it. The middle term must refer to all the members of its class at least once in the premise. That's the way I word it, but here Here's the way it's worded here. Rule number two on page 65. In a valid categorical syllogism, the middle term must be distributed at least once in the premises. Now, the middle term is easily identifiable in a categorical syllogism in that it is the term which is found twice in the premises. So all the middle term is back here because it's found twice. The middle term is whatever is found twice. Now, when you write it in the historic, it is actually the middle term. When you write it in the historic, if you put the first two premises on the same line, all men are mortal, Socrates is a man, you know, mortal will come right in the middle. But the middle term is not always easily found right in the middle, okay? But the middle term, just remember, is whatever is mentioned twice in the premises.
That didn't work for you. Because
I'm looking at man is the middle term, actually. It doesn't end up there. Okay, yeah, no. Scratch that. Just go with this as the identifying marker. Whatever mentioned twice. Yeah, scratch that on the TV. If you are listening on the cassette, scratch that. Stand corrected. Whatever is mentioned twice, and it could be like men and man, because man is contained in that group of men, okay? That is the middle term.
It's just, okay, it's just like a relational equation. You say A equals B and A equals C.
A is your middle term then, yeah.
Right.
What I'm getting at is sometimes A, B, yeah, and you can even go B, C. Yeah.
So the rule is the middle term must be the general. All of that.
Well, okay.
Is that the rule?
Yeah, we'll see it. We'll see it right here.
Well, how's it better?
Okay. It's going to come out to be that, but in about, okay, the middle term identifies the term is used twice, found twice in the premises, but the middle term has to be distributed at least once in the premises. Now, for a term to be distributed, a term is distributed in a premise when it refers to all members of the class so designated.
Okay?
So it's got to be, a term is distributed in a premise when it refers to all members of the class. So is man is the middle term, okay? It's mentioned twice in the premises. Is it distributed?
Yeah, because you got all men.
Yeah, because you got all men. And so to be distributed means you have to have all, at least once in the premises, okay? The fallacy of the undistributed middle says all donkeys are mammals. All monkeys are mammals, therefore all dogs are monkeys. Man, that looks like it's got more problems than that, but let me see. All dogs, middle term mammals, is not distributed. Okay, yeah. And by the way, distributed doesn't have to just say all. It can say all or no. Because if it says no men, it's still talking about the whole class of men, because it says no men are something, it's talking about the entire class. If it says all men are something, it's talking about the entire class. Okay? If no men wear green shirts, it tells you that all the men have something other than green shirts.
Okay.
Obviously, a
false statement.
Okay, noise comes like comes dressed in green. Okay, rule number three. In a valid syllogism, no term can be distributed in the conclusion, which is not also distributed in the premises. In other words, no term can refer to all the members of its class in the conclusion if it didn't in the premises. Okay? Again, these two, I'm not even going to...
Well, that would be easy. Socrates was mortal, Phil is mortal, therefore all men are mortal. So you didn't distribute men.
You're not going to be tested on this. In a logic course, this becomes real, real important. It's important now, but I'm not going to have you... introductory course of philosophy, defining the terms is going to be about 90% of what's going on. Okay? That you know what existentialism is the main thing. refute existentialism. It'd be nice if after the first course, your first course in philosophy, you could refute existentialism. At the same time, that's not going to be required to pass the course. Okay? And it'd be nice if you could reason well, as more of a natural ability, but I'm not going to demand that you memorize these rules. Rule number four, no categorical syllogism is valid which has two negative premises. Okay? So you just rule number four, you can't have two negative premises. That would be like saying, no men are tall. Let's see the illustration they give here. I'm having a hard time rushing and thinking at the same time. No dogs are mammals. No cats are mammals. Therefore, no dogs are cats. Okay? Some of these illustrations are really... See, the thing is, what I want you to be able to do by the end of this course, for the most part, none of us are perfect. I want you to recognize...
What fallacy that is?
No. I don't even want you to recognize what fallacy is. I want you to just recognize it is a fallacy. Okay? And so some of these rules are so complex, but when you see them violated, it's so obviously off the wall that only an idiot would buy it. I just want you to reason well. I don't want you to be able to explain how exactly that was, why exactly it's a fallacy. I just want you to know it's a fallacy. Okay? So when somebody says, no dogs are mammals, no cats are mammals, therefore no dogs are cats, I want you to look at the guy and say, man, you are out for lunch and walk away. That's all I care about. I don't need you to say, look.
Do that now.
I don't want you to say, look, rule number four is no categorical syllogism is valid, which has two negative premises. You can't use two negative premises in a deductive argument and then come out with a valid argument. Rule number five, if one premise is negative, the conclusion must also be negative. That's the way I worded it. If one premise is negative, then the conclusion must, for instance, no dogs or cats, then they say all, but a good one would be, okay, one of the premises is negative. No men are tall. Frank is a man. Frank is not tall. Okay? So, if one of the premises is negative, the conclusion must also be negative as well. Okay, and then number six, a particular conclusion can't have two universal premises. Let's see, the way they worded it was no valid categorical syllogism with a particular conclusion can have two universal premises. The example they give is all dogs are animals, no unicorns are animals, therefore some unicorns, a particular conclusion, are not dogs. When you read the examples, you see that if a fallacy is used, I mean, it is really out to lunch. I tell you, you dress it up with fancy language, you can have some fallacious, some horrible, invalid arguments that really can sound nice.
How did you define that?
I just put down a particular conclusion, such as some dogs saying something about a particular, or Socrates, that's a particular conclusion, can't have two universal premises. So it would be like, all men are mortal. All men are mortal. All men something else. Or all men are mortal. All women are mortal. And then you just broke down to some men or something else. You could end up with thinking logically comes so natural that it's very hard to try to come up with these fallacies. But anyway, we're just about, well, we got some time left. Let's move on to, that's the tools of philosophy. Chapter 5 deals with the challenge of philosophy, and we're going to really skim through this. I mean, we're going to spend about 5 minutes on this whole deal here. The challenge of philosophy, first in general, and then the challenge of philosophy for a Christian. The challenge of philosophy in general, number one, is philosophical argumentation. I mean, philosophical examination. I'm going to get right on the board. It's just spelled out in your book. Philosophical examination. Socrates said, quoted as saying, the unexamined life is not worth living. That sums it up for the philosopher. The philosopher seeks to answer the basic questions about life. So the challenge of philosophy in general is to examine life, philosophical examination of things, to question things. The philosopher seeks to answer the basic questions about life, like the purpose of life. Who am I? Where did I come from? Why am I here? Where am I going? Examining life, basic questions. The presuppositions of life. Not what we think about, but what we think with. What premises do we start with? Not just what we're thinking about. What premises, what presuppositions do we start with? So examining things that everybody else, TV said is a bad example, but, well, okay. One guy looks at the stars at night and says, man, that is beautiful. And he just leaves it at that. That's not the philosophy. The philosopher looks at the stars and says, man, that is beautiful. How did he get beautiful?
Why do I think it's beautiful?
Did it get beautiful by chance or was it designed? And why do I, what in me makes me conclude that it's beautiful? So number one, philosophical examination. Number two, clarification of thought. The clarification of thought. That's again, you know, same principle, eliminating fallacious thinking, you know, eliminating fallacies from our thinking, defining ambiguous statements, such as you could use the same word bank in two different ways, and, you know, you need to clarify as well, get rid of all the faulty reasoning that is there. Philosophy should do that. For instance, if you are pro-choice, okay, if you believe in freedom of choice, if you believe in freedom, you will be pro-abortion, because pro-abortion is pro-choice. Well, there's some fallacious reasoning there, because that means that if you're for freedom, you're for murder of certain human beings at a certain stage of life, which will go against that person's freedom to live. But it can, you know, when we define these ambiguous terms, such as the choice that they're talking about that you're for, is the choice to end the life of another human being. Number three, the challenge of philosophy in general is argumentation. Philosophy is the pursuit of truth, and argumentation is the strategy which directs that pursuit. So you're not arguing for the sake of arguing, but philosophy is dedicated to clear and correct argumentation. Number four, putting knowledge into a system of thought. A Weltanschauung is what the Germans call it. You'll see the word in the book. It's a worldview. Putting knowledge into a system of thought. Correlating the various areas of knowledge into one comprehensive system of thought, a worldview. Weltanschauung, W-E-L-T.
Oh, yeah. So that's where you start getting the wrong section.
Actually, you're in there already, right, when you philosophically examine things and you look for the purpose of life and all. So what this does is it takes what you speculate about and puts it into a worldview, like the Christian worldview, or the Muslim worldview, or the atheist worldview, or the pantheist worldview. In fact, Muslims, strictly speaking in philosophical terms, the Christian shares the same worldview as the Muslim and the Jew, the theistic worldview. But then the Christian takes that worldview further into certain Christian beliefs which the Jew and the Muslim deny. But a wealthy son must have a worldview, must have internal consistency, meaning no contradictions. You can copy my notes later, but we're really running low on time. It must have internal consistency, no contradictions, external comprehensiveness, which means it must account for all the facts of experience. If the Christian worldview can't deal with evil at all, then it isn't a worthy worldview. So we've got to answer the objection of evil. And then number three, a worldview must have correspondence. It must fit all the facts together. Okay? In a way that makes sense. And many different worldviews, deism, atheism, pantheism, polytheism, panentheism. But that's a challenge of philosophy in general. A philosophical examination, clarification of thought, argumentation in the pursuit of truth, and putting knowledge into a system of thought or worldview that makes sense. Now the challenge of philosophy for a Christian, is twofold. The twofold function of philosophy. Number one, it's to construct the Christian system of thought. That means building a good solid theology that isn't contradictory, and then being able to defend it. That's number one. And then number two, refuting contrary views. So that means formulating the Christian view and defending it, and then also refuting others that disagree.
Could you exchange construct for systematize?
Yeah, but the only thing is that to construct a worldview not only systematizes it, that's a very good word, not only systematizes the Christian theology, but also builds the wall around, builds a defense too. So it wouldn't entail that, I believe. I don't even know if they word it that way.
I think, correct me wrong, but the point is, I think what he's going is that we're not constructing the Christian society. God constructed the system of thought. The Christian viewpoint is not ours to create.
Yeah, no, but at the same time, when a person constructs his own worldview, if you're a Christian, you use the premises in the Bible to construct that worldview. But you still do construct. Two Christians don't. Probably no two Christians have the exact same worldview, every single factor.
Yeah,
because one guy interprets Hebrews 6:4-6 one way, another guy interprets it another way. But we can generally with the same Christian worldview, but how we put those premises together is, and Christians need to, we learn from the atheists when they refute our arguments, and we see that our arguments need to be constructed a little differently. And we find holes in the walls that need to be patched up. So twofold, systematizing and defending the Christian faith, and then number two, refuting contrary views. They talk about the biblical basis for Christian philosophy. A lot of verses here. I'm only going to mention 1 Peter 3:15 tells us to always be ready to defend the faith. Always be ready to defend the hope that by the gentleness and reverence. Colossians chapter 4 verses 5 and 6. Paul says, deal with non-believers, deal with outsiders with wisdom, always knowing how you should respond to them. Lots of other passages that we could bring up. Paul in Acts chapter 17 refuted the Stoic and Epicurean philosophers, but he even quoted from their writers, from their philosophers, to find some common ground with them, but then still dialogue with them. We must recognize error before we can refute it. The Bible in Colossians 2:8 forbids us to hold the false philosophies of men, but that doesn't mean that we should not hold the true philosophy of God. Romans 1:18-22 tells us that through nature God reveals His existence to us. Psalm 19:1 says the heavens declare the glory of God, the skies proclaim the work of His hands. Romans 2:14-15 tell us that God has put His moral laws in our conscience. We can argue from these things that all men have in common. We can argue to the existence of the God of the Bible and for Christianity. If philosophy means the love of wisdom, and we Christians should love wisdom, but the wisdom that comes from God is not going to be in agreement in some points with the wisdom of men, because men sometimes, even often, make mistakes. So if Sigmund Freud said he had two eyes, I don't say he's lying, he's false. No, he probably had two eyes. But when Sigmund Freud starts saying there is no God, obviously his philosophy needs some changing there. The Bible forbids the false philosophies that men have come up with. It does not forbid the true philosophy of God, the true wisdom that comes from God. The roles of philosophy for a Christian, I'm going to go over them real quick here. The function of philosophy and theology is forming a Christian worldview. The function of philosophy and apologetics is defending Christianity against external threats. The function of philosophy and polemics is defending Christianity against internal heresies like the health and wealth heresy. And the function of philosophy and communication is learning to share the gospel with people of different worldviews, removing their intellectual stumbling blocks they may have to the gospel, and presenting the gospel in a clear and consistent manner. And so that concludes our lecture there. If you need to look at my notes, go right ahead. And that's the first five chapters in Geisler's textbook, and we only have four lectures, so we're lagging kind of behind. We'll see what we can do.
Is our pace going to be one chapter per lecture?